Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Norma Walden, a volunteer program coordinator for several of the club's forums and your chair for today. We also welcome our online and radio listeners, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker today, Steve Zolno, is the author of The Future of Democracy, now in its fourth edition. He graduated from Scheimer College with a bachelor's degree in social sciences and holds a master's in educational psychology from Sonoma State University. Steve has founded and directed private schools and a healthcare agency in the Bay Area. He currently is a management and educational consultant and trainer and has led workshops on democracy for over 10 years. His workshops emphasize how democratic principles can be brought more clearly into all areas of human interaction, including government, organizations, schools, families, and our private lives. Let's welcome Steve Zolno.
Thank you very much, Norma. So I'm Steve, and this is my book, The Future of Democracy, now in its fourth edition. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for inviting me to speak, and thanks to all of you for being here. The topic I was asked to address is, do we learn from history? The answer to that question is, obviously not. I hope you enjoyed my little talk. Okay, I know some of you spent money to be here, and I know that some of you traveled quite a ways to get here. So let's try a different topic, and here's what I have in mind. How can we change our behavior in the future, both individually and as a society, based on what we learn from the past and the present? I'll say that one more time. How can we change our behavior in the future as individuals and members of society, both individually and a society based on the past and the present? So I want to do this in about three different parts. We have about an hour. And I want to start by telling you a little bit about me and how I ended up writing this book. And then I want to go through the book, give you a few quotes, give you an idea of what the book is about. And then we'll get to discussion, which is always my favorite part. When I was in high school, I would go to history classes, like we all did, and we would have a discussion or class, for example, on George Washington crossing the Delaware. Now, I don't know if he stood up or sat down, like in that painting, he was standing up, but anyway, I understand he really was sitting down. Sorry to disappoint you. And then we'd have a test. What year did George Washington cross the Delaware? Anybody know the answer to that one? 1776. Great. Very bright group. I'm just keeping notes here. Let's see what kind of grade you get. Okay. Now, what did I do with that information? I had no idea what to do with that information, right? We didn't talk about its significance. We didn't talk about if it's something I can take in my own life. Is it something that's going to make me a better citizen? I had no idea what to do with that stuff except to spit it back on a test. And I was thinking at that point, should I even bother going to college? If college is going to be like this, I don't know if I'm really interested. Then I got lucky. A high school counselor who kind of knew what I was about handed me a brochure for a little school called Scheimer College. Did anyone ever hear of Scheimer College? Oh, good. I'll tell you all about it. Scheimer College was based on the Great Books Program that came out of the University of Chicago that was designed by George Maynard Hutchins. And we would sit around in classes about 12 to 15. And instead of reading about Darwin, we would read Darwin. We'd read The Origin of the Species. Instead of reading about Newton, we would read Newton, the Principia, for example. Kind of hard on my poor little brain that hadn't been developed very well in the realm of reading all this difficult stuff. But it was a challenge. I got through it. But what was really significant about this school for me was that I had to come up with my own ideas. I had to come up with my own interpretation of what this stuff was about. And our teachers were not called teachers. They were called facilitators. So I had to compare my impression of what Newton had to say or what Darwin had to say was the impression of the other people who were in the class. Quite a challenge, you might say. But for me, it was a great experience. The reason was that, number one, I had to come up with my own interpretation. Number two, I had to compare my thoughts with other people's thoughts. So what that taught me was, in a democratic way, that we could work toward a common understanding. You're going to be hearing that theme a lot tonight. After college, I came out here, got involved in what was called in those days, the early 70s, the alternative school business. And I got involved in a little school in the Haight-Ashbury called Rivendell. Anybody hear of that one? Okay. Rivendell was on Cole Street. And the kids that we got were having difficulty in public schools. Some of them couldn't read, even if they were 10 years old. Some of them had behavior problems. Some of them had learning disabilities. And some of them had all of the above. And how do we get these kids involved in learning? We, instead of telling them this is math, this is reading, and this is arithmetic, these are all the things you need to learn about, we would ask them what they're interested in. So, for example, just about all kids from about 6 to 12 are interested in horses or volcanoes or earthquakes. So we were able to get their interest by creating topics that were relevant to their lives. And we would have, for example, a trip that went up to the earthquake exhibit at Point Reyes. And they would get excited, and they'd read about earthquakes. Kids who couldn't read at the age of 10 all of a sudden could read. Kids who were not interested in math, the way it's normally taught, they had to plan a budget. So guess what? They learned math. They had to write and plan an itinerary. They had to look at maps. In those days, we had a thing called maps. So they had to actually read maps and route the direction that we were going to go. So these kids really got excited about learning. But I think what was the most important thing about the school was that when kids had disputes, and of course kids aren't the only ones that have disputes, we would sit them in a room and say, okay, kids, work out your problems and we'll, and then we'll help you if you need it. And they got to be very, very good at talking to each other and listening to each other and learning how to work out their own difficulties, which was a very democratic system in a lot of ways when you think about it. We got involved if we had to, but generally we didn't. Then I became a consultant after that for nonprofits. I worked for a little while for the American Friends Service Committee and the Red Cross, and we had the management staff come in, and we talked about what was the purpose of the organization. And did I go in and tell them, this is the purpose of the organization and this is what you should do? No. We asked them, what do you think is the purpose of the organization? And together, in a very democratic way, they talked about what were their priorities and how are we going to work together toward manifesting that purpose in the real world. So fast forward about 10 years, I became involved in the healthcare field, became a manager, and we had a program, and the program still exists, out in Contra Costa County. And we worked with children and adults, some of whom were very disabled. Some of these children are in wheelchairs, they're in feeding tubes, and their lives, unfortunately, are not going to be very long. But a lot of the program, you may think this is a medical program. It was, to a certain extent. We had doctors and nurses, of course, provide all of the, all of the orders for the basic medical care. But with the staff, some of whom only have a high school education, we asked them, what do you think is the most important thing we do with our residents? And we talk about that. And they come up with these plans based on their knowledge and their information about the residents that was better than anything any of us could come up with. Those of you who've ever been in a hospital, you know there's good nurses and not so good nurses, right? And I'd venture to say that the good nurses are the ones who are paying attention. the ones who you feel a connection with. So this is what we try to do. We try to get our staff involved and connected with the people that that we serve. And it really makes them into better staff instead of me going in again and saying, this is what you should do, and this is how you do it. Okay? So a little bit about how the book was written. In the year 2006, you remember who the president was? Nobody remembers? Good. Okay, class, you're doing great. Okay, I got two right so far. Kind of. Bush was the president. And if you remember, he said that he represented real American values. Does anybody remember him saying that? Mm-hmm. So a group of us got together and we said, we're not sure if he really represents American values. Let's check it out. Let's see. So we put together a discussion group. We met once a month for about 10 years. And we studied the Constitution, we studied the founders, and we studied what made them come up with the ideas that they came up with. They studied the Enlightenment authors, for example, Locke, Rousseau, and Voltaire. And those people said, for example, that in order to establish the kind of government you want, you may have to overthrow the government if it's oppressive. And that's where they got some of those ideas. They studied the Greeks, and they were very, very educated. Some of them spoke Greek, and some of them spoke Latin. So they're a very, very highly educated group. A lot of us don't appreciate that at this point. So in the book, we start out, there's three chapters, and we start out with democracy's past, democracy's present, and the third chapter is democracy's future. And the kind of questions that we ask, we started a little bit philosophically. The kind of questions we ask are, where did people get the idea of freedom? What is it within each of us that wants to be free? Why is human dignity so important? When you think way, way back to our ancestors, at a time perhaps before there was such a thing as Homo sapiens, think back to that time, and we were pretty much, our ancestors were pretty much run by instinct. And then all of a sudden, maybe it wasn't so sudden, maybe it happened over a long period of time, our ancestors started to realize that they wanted freedom, that they were human beings, that they wanted to have appreciation for who they were, that they wanted human dignity. And that's sort of when we started moving in the direction of democracy. Let me give you a quote here. I want to quote a little bit from the introduction. This is from the end of the introduction. The section is called Democracy and Human Dignity. Democracy is rooted in the struggle for human dignity. The above definition, which is at the beginning of the book, an organization or system in which everyone is treated equally and has equal rights, describes its essential nature. As our earliest societies expanded in size from small to larger groups, we gave up egalitarian self-rule and lost our ability to make the major decisions that affect our lives. So as we got bigger and bigger in our societies, we had more of a distance between us and our rulers. Democracy is an attempt to restore self-rule and the dignity that comes with it. But democracy rarely has lived up to its potential due to the ability of some members of a society to dominate others. Thus, for those who believe in democracy, it is our responsibility to discuss and monitor how best to maintain it. This book is the story of the long struggle for human dignity and its denial over time, and how we can affect the outcome of that struggle. So the book goes on, covers most civilizations, most of the larger civilizations. We talk about China and India, and we build up to Egypt. And as you know, the Exodus, whether it really happened or not historically, there's no evidence for it. But it is one of the founding myths of Western society. And what I mean by that is it's a model for freedom, how people became free, how people felt oppressed, and they moved toward a greater sense of freedom. And then we keep moving forward until we get to the Greeks. As I'm sure most of you know, the Greeks had the first actual model for what was called democracy. And democracy really is a Greek term that means government by the people. They were very proud of their democracy. Pericles, who built the Acropolis, this is a picture I took, by the way, of the Erechtheian temple on top of the Acropolis. Pericles built the Acropolis, but he also was a general. In those days, the generals and the leaders of the were the same people. So there was a battle between Sparta and Athens in about 400 BCE. Does anyone know what that was called? Okay, Peloponnesian War. Okay, didn't get that one, so let me make a note here. All right. You guys are doing pretty well. I got 2 out of 3. Not bad. Okay. I want you to hear about his speech. Now, his speech may or may not be exactly the way it happened, because Thucydides was one of the very first historians, and he wrote basically what he thought happened. He wasn't there, probably, watching Pericles give this speech. What happened was they had a battle, and there were many men dying or dead on the field. This is very similar to Lincoln's Gettysburg Address in some ways. I think you'll agree. Okay, listen to this. If we look to the laws, they afford equal justice to all in their private differences. If no social standing, advancement in public life falls to reputation for capacity, class considerations not being allowed to interfere with merit. Nor again does poverty bar the way. If a man is able to serve the state, he is not hindered by the obscurity of his condition. So they were very proud of democracy. But what I add to this, equal justice to all, as used by Pericles here, actually applied to only 10% of the persons who were citizens. So about 10% of the population, maybe there were 300,000 Athenians at this time, and about 10% were considered to be citizens who actually could participate in democracy. Now, I don't know if you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it was tremendous progress. It had never been tried before. So it's very, very important you think about this. From their point of view, they were tremendously progressive. 10% of the people could participate in democracy, but it was the most progressive thing that had ever happened. Now, as you may have noticed, even in democracy, some people rise to the top and they are in control, and other people sort of stay at other levels. And the person who probably challenged the Athenian authority at that time the most was Socrates. Okay? And Socrates very famously said, "I know nothing." He was eventually executed in 399 BCE by the Athenian authorities because they considered him to be a threat. He was out there trying to make people think, right? And they didn't want people to think too much. They wanted them pretty much to, you know, to follow their authority. So he said, "I know nothing." That's not very profound, is it? If I stood up here and said, "I know nothing," you'd say, "Okay, thanks, bye." Right? But what did he mean by that? Did he mean that he gets up every morning and has to remember how to brush his teeth again, has to relearn how to walk? Is that what he meant by "I know nothing"? No, that's not what he meant, I don't think. I think what he meant was that we all have concepts. If you walk down the street, you're going to see a tree. And you have a concept of tree. Oh, there's a tree. I've seen those before. I know what a tree is. But your concept and my concept of tree has probably not too much to do with what the actual tree is. You follow what I'm talking about? If I see a person and I see, oh, there's a white person. Well, I know all about white people, And if I see a Jewish person, well, I know all about them, right? You know, they have big noses and they have a lot of money and they run Hollywood, right? In fact, after this talk, I'm going to go down to Hollywood to my studio and continue running it. So I think what he's getting at, and I think this is very, very important, is that our concepts, our preconceptions are what run us. And to a certain extent, when we interact with other people, what we see is our concepts. We don't see the person that's in front of us. We don't see the tree that's in front of us. Okay? We don't see, if we say the word chair, for example, there's one kind of chair, there's another kind of chair, but in our minds, we have a concept about what a chair is. So we're going around with these concepts, and they keep us, to a large extent, from paying attention to what we see in front of us. Einstein said something very similar, and we're going to get into that in just a minute. Okay, fast forward here to the American Revolution. We've talked about that a little bit. Now, we all know a little bit about the American Revolution. We all know when George Washington crossed the Delaware, right? We got that one down, right? But what do we know about their motivation? What do we know about what they were really trying to do, what they were really trying to accomplish? They used the word democracy to a certain extent. Not too much, by the way. The actual Constitution and the Articles of Confederation and the Declaration of Independence did not use the term democracy. The actual Constitution used the term instead that we are a republic, right? Good. All right, you guys are doing great. I have a little surprise for you, by the way, toward the end, which I think you'll enjoy. Okay. So we end the chapter with a summary of history in respect of the extent to which democracy was becoming more prevalent or less prevalent in various countries right up until the end of the 20th century. The second chapter is called Democracy's Present, and that covers about 11 countries around the world, and all of these countries, except for Britain does not have a written constitution. They have traditions starting back at the time of the Magna Carta. But all the rest of these countries have constitutions. Russia and China, for example, they have constitutions. And their constitutions talk about how democratic they are. Are you surprised? So a constitution is not going to say, oh, we're going to be a bunch of autocrats and we're going to tell you what to do and you're not going to have a voice in government. No constitution is going to say that. They're all going to pretend or allege that they are democratic. The People's Democratic Socialist Republic, right? Okay. They use that word. They use that word, democracy. So the problem is, and the point that I make in this chapter, is that just because you have a constitution doesn't mean that democracy is necessarily going to prevail. Everybody hear that? Okay. We have a constitution. Some people in this room might think we're getting closer to democracy, depending on which channel you watch, right? Some people may think that we're getting further from democracy in our country. If you look around the world right now, Hungary, Poland, Venezuela, Turkey, the list goes on. A lot of these countries, at least from the way I see it, in spite of having a constitution that promises democracy, they're moving further and further from democracy. The third chapter is Democracy's Future. And it starts out with a quote from Einstein that I talked to you about earlier. Let me give you that quote. And we'll try to tie it into the whole idea of democracy. All concepts, even those that are closest to experience, are from the point of view of logic, freely chosen conventions, just as is with the case of causality. All concepts are freely chosen conventions. What do you think he meant by that? Okay. Remember the theory of relativity? The theory of relativity is really, that's kind of what it's about. It's kind of about that each of us have our own point of view. Each of us look at things a little bit differently. And, of course, it's a very, very complex scientific formula, theory that he used for that. But it's very, very important to realize, I think, that, again, when we look at things, we all have, coming at it from our own point of view, our own background orients us toward what we see and what we don't see. So in Democracy's Future, we talk about how we can take the principles of democracy, and democracy is more of a principle than any particular one form of government. There's no two forms of government that consider themselves democracies that are exactly the same. And in that chapter, we talk about how we can bring democracy into a number of different areas: education, justice, the economy, the environment, healthcare, religion, science, violence and war, international relations, and politics. So this probably is the chapter that, if you buy the book, it's probably the one you want to spend the most time looking at, because how do we bring democracy into all these different areas, particularly the political realm? One principle here that I think is very important to remember is that democracy means the same thing it's always meant: government by the people. And the first three words of the Constitution are, "We the people," right? Okay. And what is meant by that? What do they mean by "we the people"? At that time when the Constitution was written, we also weren't doing very well as far as including all the people. We had slaves, Indians were excluded, women were excluded, right? So about 30%, a little better than Greece, about 30% of the people at that time were actually included. But the principle stayed. And as time went on, luckily, we started moving toward greater and greater inclusion. We started getting more and more people involved in voting. More and more people were able to run for office. 1919, we had the amendment that allowed women to vote. So that's half the population right there. So you can see that we have an ideal. It's called democracy. And then we have the reality, which may or may not come even close to what the ideal is. But for some reason, in this country, we've been able to come closer and closer to realizing that ideal. And another point I try to make in the book is that at any time, we can be moving closer to democracy or further from democracy. And it's anybody's opinion about where we're going in our country right now, but it's not this exact standard by which we look at a country and say they're democratic or they're not democratic. It doesn't work that way. We're either getting more democratic or less democratic at any time. So I'm going to open it up to questions now, see what people think about the idea about democracy. The discussion is always my favorite part, so please, yeah. I think we wanted to bring, I'm sorry, we wanted to bring the microphone over to you.
We need to have all the questions recorded. Yeah. It's kind of odd, you know, if you have recorded answers with no questions that are heard on the recording. So I'll be happy to bring the microphone around and we can pass it around. Please just raise your hand if you have a question.
This gentleman right here was.
Okay. I'll start coming in.
In the context of that, do you think compulsory voting is a good idea?
Compulsory voting? No, I don't. Because if I tell you you have to vote, what do you think your reaction is going to be so you can remain a free person? No, I don't have to. I think that's my impression about what most people. I know some countries have introduced compulsory voting in Europe right now. I don't think it would work here. Let's put it that way.
Thank you.
Sure.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Are there any exceptions to where people migrate to for a better life that did not have a lot of UK governance and influence?
That's a good question. Not that I know of. Unfortunately, people are dying to get into this country. Literally, as you know, they're dying to get into Europe. There's boats coming from Somalia and Africa right now. A lot of it is economic, but not all of it. Some people I just want to have more freedoms. So no, I really don't know that we are. We're as you implied there, our government is based on norms that came from England, essentially.
Thank you.
Sure.
And I'll just take a moment to remind our listening audience that this program is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker is Steve Zulno. The title of our program is Do We Learn from History? And I see a couple of questions starting here.
Was Iraq under Saddam Hussein a secular government and therefore a democratic with a Republican flavor?
Well, I'll have to think about that one. A lot of governments try to convince, especially autocratic governments, try to convince their people that they are legitimate by claiming an allegiance to religion. And I think Iraq fell under that category. But I don't see that they actually were, as far as we know, really, really tied to any particular religion. Of course, they all claim to be under the Muslim religion. But this is something that's kind of good to get into. There are many different divisions within the Muslim religion. I happen to have some very close friends who are Muslim, and they're the most peaceful people I know. They came from Afghanistan. Some of their best friends were Jewish and Christian when they lived in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, they had to leave. So, again, getting into preconceptions, we have preconceptions about people from certain religions, but you'll find within any religion, I believe, you'll find more a more peaceful element, an element that wants to connect with others, and an element that wants to be separate.
This is a judgment call. I've been reading a lot of political scientists, many of whom believe that we're very much or very close to losing democracy permanently. And the question is whether we see somewhere a countervailing force coming up to save us. It won't be the Democrats, because if we have the Democrats, we still have the division, the hyperpartisanship. So how in the world do we reverse this trend? And how optimistic are you?
I was afraid you were going to ask that. I'm very optimistic. And in fact, at the very end of this talk, we'll get into that a little bit more. But we really have a choice. And unfortunately, my background, by the way, my degree is in educational psychology. And I think that, I'm sorry about the voice, by the way, I have a little allergy right now. I think that within every human being, we have a tendency to want to follow what we've always done. And we have a tendency to want to be free. So both of those are going on at the same time. And from what I can tell, we have what we call conservative, and we have what we call liberal elements and, combinations of those. But the definition of conservative and liberal continually changes. If you go to England, it means entirely something different over there. So to get back to your question, hopefully, am I optimistic? I'd say yes, I am. But what we're talking about here is something that we all can do. We're talking about the way that we educate our children. We're talking about something that's long term. I guess you can say democracy wasn't built in a day. It took thousands of years before we got to the point where we are. And we're always going to go forward. And we're always going to backtrack. And starting here and now, everybody in this room can do something about it. We're going to get into that a little bit more. And everyone can do something about moving us closer or further from democracy. Some of the things that some people do is they join NGOs, non-government organizations. They protest in those pink hats. They do a lot of things. And these things are all significant. These things are all very, very important. But I think that what's unique about this country is that, if you recall, we started out with the Declaration of Independence. the Declaration of Independence was about what we don't want. We don't want oppression, right? We don't want to have King George telling us what to do. Now, that wasn't really economic. That was pretty much philosophical because the people that started the revolution, they were fine financially, right? We went on for about 10 years under the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation didn't work because they allowed too much freedom for the states. They had their own import-export rules. They had their own relationships with other countries. Didn't work. So that's when, at that point in 1787, we got together and put together the Constitution. So the reason our Constitution is unique in history is that it's forward-looking. It says, this is what a democratic government should look like. Again, only about 30% of the people were able to take advantage of this at that time, right? But it put into place the concept of we the people, which has been expanding by fits forward and backward, right? But it has been expanding. And it's the model for the rest of the world. At least it's the model for people in the world who believe in democracy. So we have something to be proud of, but are we moving closer or further from that model? The answer to that is yes. Yeah. Yeah. We're moving further sometimes. We're moving closer sometimes. And if I was to predict 100 years from now, are we still going to have democracy? I'd say it's anybody's guess. Depends on what we do. Best answer I can give you right now. But in 100 years, let's check in. Let's see how it looks.
Hi. In terms of your research and writing on democracy of the future, one of the things that I sort of observe, and in this age of that we can't agree on truth anymore, it seems almost impossible to participate democratically if we don't even share facts, etc. So in terms of what makes democracies fail or work and what we need to do to make them work better towards the future, one of the observations that I have is that throughout history, democracies fail when the values that you make laws over are exclusive based on religion, status, culture, race. But then there's sort of movements of reason when there's betterment and progress, when it's based on values that are kind of like going back to the early framers, the more self-evident universal values. Mm. So my question is, how can you teach, promote that difference while not trampling on people's freedom of thought, you know, to bring their religious, cultural views into play in how they participate in a democracy? Yet how do we, not just in school, but almost like on a daily basis, even reminding adults, how can we learn that key difference of like, you know what, in history, at least for me, it seems like nothing ever good came from law when, you know, religious ideas, cultural ideas, racial divisions were put into law. So when things turned out really well is when kind of universal values were put into law. So how do we change the conversation? Not so much of like, are we democratic or not, but are we like moving forward or we're stuck because of this inability? You know, there's no way that you're going to get two very different religions to agree on what they want to do moving forward. So how do you get them to step back and say, okay, the religion, that's part of our personal freedom, not part of this public freedom. Okay. So what are your thoughts on that?
Okay. Well, we're doing it now. First of all, very, very important. Don't underestimate the power of conversation. Don't underestimate the power of dialogue. And every one of you can go out and have a conversation just like this. You know, I know there's some great TV shows on, but what's really important? What are our priorities? I heard an expression recently, we can build bridges or we can build walls. I've heard something about a certain president who wants to build walls. Won't mention any names. But what are we doing in our own lives? What are we doing in our educational system? What are we doing when we get together with friends? What are we doing in that famous scene at Thanksgiving where we have Uncle Joe come in and he only watches one station and we only watch the other one, right? How do we have that conversation? And the way we have that conversation is by, this is why I brought Socrates into this, and this is why I brought Einstein's idea into this. People really are just people. I want to tell you a little bit about the legislative work that I do, and didn't mention that at all. In my field, we're always underfunded. So I've worked with Democrats and Republicans in Sacramento. There was a time when I was spending almost half my time in Sacramento. And I didn't really care who was a Republican or a Democrat. I'm also on the board of a state providers organization for people who do the kind of work that I do. Most of them are Republicans. So what's important is you go back to what are the principles here? What is it that we're really after? Are we after democracy? And what is democracy? But you have to be willing to have that conversation with other people. And part of it is looking at people as people instead of just looking at them as Democrats, Republicans, having certain racial characteristics, what their religion is. And ultimately, you have to decide, who's going to be the adult in the room? Who's going to bridge that gap? Who is going to get beyond the stereotypes? That's very, very important, I think, to take a look at. And hopefully we're making a little progress in this direction. Also, I'm a big campaigner for this. I'm giving 3 talks this week alone, just so you know. So I'm out there trying to put it out. I think someone over there had a question. Yeah.
Hello. I had a conversation with my children this last week, and I'm also in education, and we talked about the difference between a decision by a committee where everybody comes with their own personal wants and objectives, and there's a compromise where you have this not an objective, but a lot of objectives, and everybody agrees to have their own way versus coming together and having, like you're saying, one objective and thinking of the group's better, their common good. And I know we had a really heated discussion because my children, they're young adults, and they really feel when they look at the government that it's by committee and it has nothing to do with them. And I thought that was really interesting. Coming from my perspective, I see it in a whole different light. And so they bring in the idea of a lot of special interest groups and how voices aren't being heard. So maybe some comments that you would have in regards to that.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Is that one of your children next to you there? Who you're just talking about that's hiding over there? Yeah. Okay. Well, welcome. Glad you're here. Glad you're here with your daughter. Remember, I was a teacher, so I've dealt with kids a lot. This is not the way it was supposed to be. When they wrote the Constitution, does anybody know how long it took them to write the Constitution?
4 months.
That's right, 4 months. Boy, you guys are really good. Okay. Write that down. Okay, good. You're getting an A so far. Well, maybe a B plus. It's not supposed to be this way. When they got together, spent those 4 months, they had huge arguments. They had fights, right? They made a big compromise about slavery, for example, and a lot of other things. So the United States was not built in a day, right? But eventually they came to a compromise. What was the compromise? The compromise was based on those first 3 words, we the people. And from their point of view, they pretty much encapsulized the meaning of how to manifest that term, we the people. From our point of view, looking at that now, they're pretty backward. But you can see how that principle, there's a principle of democracy and there's the reality. And as time goes on, we're getting closer and closer to realizing what that principle is all about. My guess is 10, 20 years from now, we'll look back and people will say, in 2018, boy, they were so backwards. You know? So That's something to realize. They have to have the conversation. What you're doing is really, really great. Do you talk about the same kind of thing with the kids in your school, too?
I'm the special ed coordinator, so I basically focus on other issues, but I'm an advocate for their voice, teach them how to be their own voice, so in that way I instill those principles in them in more in a personal way.
Well, I think it's really important. I work, by the way, with people who are severely disabled, some of them. It's important never to underestimate anyone's intelligence. From my point of view, everyone can make a contribution. Everyone. And you just have to find out what that contribution is, and you have to find that little spark in every person. And you know what? They're looking for the same thing we're all looking for. We're all looking for recognition. Last talk I gave, I asked people, what are people looking for? We're all looking for recognition. We're all looking for a sense of validity. The problem is, I want that from you, and you want that from me. So how do we get that? Again, who's going to be the adult in the room? The way I get a sense of validity is by giving it to you. And then we have something started. Then we can have a conversation. But if I'm thinking my point of view is superior, and you think your point of view is superior, then it gets personal. Yeah, the conversation is personal. And what I mean by that is it becomes who's right and who's wrong. It becomes who's a valid person and who's not. See what I'm talking about? So maybe we're talking issues, but we're really talking about personal stuff. And that's really something to keep in mind. Someone right here had a quick, someone right there, sorry.
In the United States today, what is the biggest threat? Technology, greed, or toxic masculinity?
Are those the three choices?
There could be more.
Okay. I'm glad you brought that up. Because I saw a cartoon this last weekend. Non sequitur, has anyone seen that cartoon? Oh, it's a great cartoon. This particular one was really, really good. And it had two cavemen about to throw rocks at each other, right? And one said, I'm defending my women. The other one said, no, I'm defending my women, right? And they threw these big boulders at each other. And the boulders bounced up in the air and landed on them. They were both crushed. And then the women came along, stood on top of the boulders. Way to go! We got rid of those guys, right? Terrific cartoon. You got to look that up. So, let me put it this way. I think you have to get, again, away from relying on generalities. Okay? I remember not too long ago, people said we should elect a woman as president, right? Did you want Phyllis Schlafly as president? You know what I mean? So it's not just because someone is a woman doesn't mean they necessarily are going to represent the values that you want. I would say everything being equal, I sure would probably vote, you know, for a woman. I'm not going to tell you I voted for in the last election. You can probably guess. But the idea is we have to emphasize principles, not people. What's the principle behind democracy that we're really looking for? Not parties. Some of us, this is San Francisco, I can guess which party most people here might be aligned with. But parties are not always doing it right either, right? A lot of us, of course, are not happy, including a lot of Republicans, with what's going on right now. But there were things under the last administration which I thought should have been done and could have been done a lot better, right? And just because you elect a president, if Hillary had been elected, doesn't mean that everything is going to get better necessarily. It doesn't mean it's going to solve everything. So what we have to do is we have to hold our politicians' feet to the fire, and we have to elect people who understand the idea of democracy, which is essentially respecting every human being.
Thank you for the talk. Very interesting and very insightful. from your educational background, you mentioned about the alternative education model. I think that's a wonderful thing to do to every child. Why it's not become mainstream?
Okay, that's a really great question. Glad you asked that.
Thank you.
It is becoming more mainstream. My daughter went to a school called Oakland Tech, not too far from where I live in Oakland, and they have what was called a Paideia program. And the Paideia program is a Greek term, basically means people talking together and learning together, as opposed to having top-down instruction. So a lot of schools are initiating those kinds of programs, and I think it's a lot of progress. Unfortunately, it's not as far spread as I would like to see it spread. But let me put it this way about education. Some teachers think that they are experts. They spend a lot of time in school. Let's say they're teaching history. Let's stick with history for now. And they know what history is. They know what's important. And kids are going to learn it my way. Some teachers learn from history that there's not one right way to do things. That's the impression that they have. And they learn from history that working together with other people and soliciting their opinion so that they can form their own opinions is a better system for educating children. And we are moving more in that direction now, I think. But again, it goes back and forth. And like we said at the beginning, democracy can be brought more fully into every situation. Education, government, family. But it's a matter of putting it out there and determining whether we're going to be able to move in that direction. And when I'm talking about here, as far as democracy is concerned, is respecting people's opinions and having them develop more independent points of view. Did I answer your question? Sorry, go ahead. Would you pass the microphone back so it can be recorded? Thanks.
Actually, I have another question. You mentioned the 10 years you had a debating group. And is this book as a result of that? If it is, what are those members? And I'm just curious about them. And that would help you so much to form such thoughts and insights. Okay. Thank you.
Wasn't a debating group. I was real clear about it. It was a discussion group. And we tried to come to conclusions by reading about what was the basis of, first of all, our country and democracy in general. So it wasn't a debating group. The sources are all out there. As I mentioned, I went to a college where we read original sources. And that's essentially what we did. We read a lot of original sources going back to the origins of democracy. And that's how we came to the conclusions that we came to, and that's how the book got written. Sorry.
One could argue that the most important educational institution in society is adolescents watching adults deal with problems in the real world. And if you look at it from that point of view, as a millennial, you must be appalled. Do you have a comment on that?
That was education up until the time when we formally had schools. Basically, children would watch their parents, and they would adopt, in most cases, in the Middle Ages, they would adopt their parents' skill set. So that essentially was what it was. And then around the time of the Renaissance, more people were given books and more people were expected to be more educated and more broadly educated because we had a new appreciation for the Greeks. And basically Aristotle was considered to be the model for how people should learn at that time. So that essentially was what it was. There was no thinking about what are the principles of democracy, what are the principles behind what human beings really should be seeking until that time. Got another question here.
I'm thinking back to reading a dialogue or two of Plato's a long, long time ago, and there was one in which a fellow named Thrasymachus was arguing that justice is whatever is in the interest of the stronger party. And Socrates spends a lot of time trying to argue him out of that. Of course, Socrates wins the argument. He tends to do that. But I've been thinking that Thrasymachus is kind of right. If you look at our system now, we over many decades have built up a stronger and stronger chief executive, regardless of whether you like the current guy or not. We've made the chief executive, the president, a stronger party of our government, where the Constitution originally was intending to make the legislative body strongest. And in the legislature, we don't have people cooperating as much as we have them arguing, and the stronger wins there. And even in the judicial system, we have people appointing very partisan judges. And that's not democracy to me either. And we have large contributors who also have a lot of influence over the system. I see lots of situations where the stronger party seems to be determining what happens rather than some broader sense of right and wrong. So I'm feeling a little optimistic, a little less optimistic than you are. I'm glad to see your optimism, but convince me I'm wrong.
Okay, we have a debate here. What do you know? In the book, I quote George Washington's farewell address. Does anybody know what that was about? He basically said that we should not have political parties. And the reason we should not have political parties is because we should be looking at principles. Okay? And what's happened to a certain extent related to what you're talking about is people have allegiance to parties, they have allegiance to leaders, and we get away from the principles. So what I'm talking about basically is we need to keep reminding ourselves, and that's basically what the book is about. And we need to keep reminding our friends, and we need to keep reminding our politicians in town hall meetings or whatever, that the principle of democracy is that which serves the greatest number of people. And you have to keep going back to that and back to that. So am I optimistic? Yes, I think we can do that. Around the world, we're seeing some problems with that being enacted, with the democracy being maintained. So again, it's a bit of a choice. So I think we have to finish up in about 5 or 10 minutes. And then just so you know, we're going to have a book signing for those who want to buy the book. And I have a sign-up list for people who are interested in our monthly newsletter or possibly attending our monthly meetings. They're in Oakland near the Rock Ridge area. Any more questions?
Just a quick one. Do you think we should remove party affiliations from voting ballots?
That's a good question. Okay, just to be transparent here, I'm a declining to state. Okay. In California, it's called a declining to state. It's not called independent. So the reason I'm a declining to state is because I started paying attention to what the Democrats are doing and the Republicans are doing, and I realized that they all fall a little bit short of the ideal that I had in mind. So I'd say probably I would leave that as a choice. I wouldn't tell people whether they should register as a Democrat or Republican. I'm, as you probably have figured out by now, much more emphatic about educating people. So if people want to register as a Democrat or Republican, hopefully they keep in mind that just because you elected a Democrat, they can give you all kinds of reasons why a lot of Democrats, including a lot of black Americans, by the way, were dissatisfied with a lot of things Obama did. Just because you elect a leader doesn't mean you spend the rest of your time reading 50 Shades of Grey and hoping that things are going to get better. Right? Nothing wrong with 50 Shades of Grey, don't get me wrong. But you want to make sure you maintain an active engagement with democracy at all levels. And that's, if I'm preaching anything, that's what I'm preaching.
We have the microphone here.
Okay.
I was surprised recently with The Economist, where it has its annual democracy index, to see that they categorized the United States as a flawed democracy. I'm not a scholar of theory at all, but as someone who has studied history and thought deeply about democracy, if you were to make one change to the original U.S. Constitution, what would that be to secure the American democracy more fully?
Well, the changes actually have been made, and you'll hear certain people say that the Constitution was great just the way it is. Some people in the Supreme Court will say that, except they forgot that the part, the Constitution also has a part that allows for amendments. So even the people that wrote the Constitution didn't think by any means it was perfect. And the original Constitution mentioned slavery and allowed for slavery. And it wasn't until 1808 when the Constitution even allowed for us to debate that subject. So for sure, that's a bit of a problem. But it has been amended. So I'd say it's not the Constitution itself so much, although Citizens United is another area that that I have some problems with. But it's not so much the Constitution itself. It's how we understand the Constitution, how we talk to each other. And are we talking to each other in a way that we're moving closer or further from democracy?
You commented early on that there were no two democracies that were the same. When you look at all the different flavors out there, what are just how would you not so much rank, but comment on each aspect? You know, whether it's two-party, multi-party, parliamentary, direct democracy. I mean, just sort of what aspects of different democracies that you find are getting you closer to the ideal?
Okay. Do you have another hour? Okay. I don't think there's any system that's necessarily better than any other system, to be honest with you. The parliamentary system has been shown to be a very good system. It's probably prevalent in, I have to check this out, probably prevalent in more countries than any other that I know of right now. Parliamentary system, simply put, is people vote for parties, not for people, and then the prime minister becomes the result of a coalition. And we vote more directly, although it's through an electoral college, for our executives. So it's not really direct. So I don't think any system is better than the other. I think that basically education is what we need to go for, and interaction. And I want to read you the very last part of the book and then ask you a question if there's no more questions. No more questions? Okay. I want to read you the very end of the book, which doesn't mean you shouldn't buy it, by the way. But here's basically where we're heading for. We were talking about voting before, and it's very important to realize that voting is not democracy in itself. They have an election, I think, coming up in Russia. It's meaningless, right? Okay. So let me read you a little bit from the last couple pages of the book. People often think that democracy is just about voting, but voting also happens in countries where democracy is a sham. In places where leaders don't have an interest in serving the public, or perhaps even a concept about how to do so. True democracy is about responsibility on the part of all members of society to understand and commit themselves to actions that move toward greater respect for every human being. And being optimistic again for a minute. We can bring democracy more fully into every human situation, including our families, schools, organizations, and nations. Each best serves our needs when we strive to extend dignity and respect to every human being. We also can bring democracy more fully into our interpersonal interactions as we develop the art of listening to each other. And the way it ends, here are some questions to get us started. When you have a conversation with others, you can ask, what kind of world, a relationship, family, organization, or nation do we want for ourselves that is compatible with human dignity and justice? So not just a conversation, but a conversation about what is compatible with human dignity and justice. Next, what does it actually look like in the real world? So it's not just having a concept, but how do we execute that? How do we make that apparent, and how do we make that a lived reality? And the third one, what steps can we take together to move together toward that vision? So again, it's not just identifying what to do, but how can you and I together work toward that vision? So, a little surprise that I promised you. As you probably figured out by now, I'm not an absolutist, right? I really believe in democracy and dialogue toward a common purpose. However, there's one thing I really believe is the one true answer to something. Whoops, I got real excited there. Okay, when people look at the book, they say, the title is The Future of Democracy. Does democracy have a future? And I have an opinion about that. I think it's the right answer. First person to get the right answer gets a free copy of the book, which I'll sign afterwards. Yeah. It depends on that. Damn! You got it right away. Great. Okay. So I was just kidding about grading the class, but you definitely get an A. Okay.
Could you repeat what she said?
Okay. She said was, it depends on us. Does democracy have a future? It depends on us. So keep that in mind. It depends on everybody in this room going out and implementing democracy in every situation that you're involved in. Thanks for being here, and I really enjoyed it. I learn more from conversations than you believe. I sometimes revise the book in the next edition based on conversations I have with people. So thanks a lot.
Our thanks to our speaker, Steve Zolno, author of The Future of Democracy. As he mentioned, copies of his book will be available for purchase, and he'll be glad to autograph copies for you. We also thank our audience for your interest and good questions. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, in its 115th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.